1965 in review. This is Pye Chamberlain with a review of the sounds, voices, and stories that made news in 1965.
This is really war.
In Vietnam, it is really war. For the first time since Korea, Americans are fighting and dying in large numbers overseas. 240 died in a single week of 1965, a greater toll than any week in Korea. America now has about 200,000 men in Vietnam, supplemented by small contingents of Australian and South Korean troops. And as the pressure from the communist North continues, more will be sent. In the coming year, there may be as many as 500,000 American GIs fighting in the dirty jungle war. Why? American officials spend much of their time explaining that. Secretary of State Dean Rusk says,
"Our forces are there to help independent peoples resist aggression. Our troops could come home tomorrow if the aggressors would go north, go back home, and stay at home. But the defeat of these aggressions is not only essential if Laos and South Vietnam are to remain independent. It is important to the security of Southeast Asia as a whole."
Vice President Hubert Humphrey underlined the importance of America's continuing the struggle.
"Make no mistake about it. If we weary of our responsibilities, if we don't have the patience and the persevering patience to follow through, the communist has. And we are facing this technique of nibble, nibble, bite, bite, touch, touch, all over the world. And we're going to face it. And that's why we have to take action on occasion that is misunderstood, sometimes purposely."
Against President Johnson's Vietnam policy are lined up not only the Viet Cong guerrillas and North Vietnamese regulars, but a small, if growing, minority of Americans. These include not only the bearded, stringy-haired peace marchers, but aged men, matrons, and even ranking political figures of the president's own Democratic Party. Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon, for example.
"Unfortunately, we went in there joining with them from the beginning, so-called advisors, but we did the bombing, not the South Vietnamese. We even took South Vietnamese truck drivers and put them on a helicopter so we could say that there was a South Vietnamese in the helicopter as we dropped the napalm bombs on villages, killing innocent women and children, as well as, we hope, some Viet Cong. No, our record is a sordid and a sorry and a sad one in regard to our unilateral action. We are a complete outlaw in Southeast Asia. We've been an outlaw from the beginning, and so have the communists."
And two Americans made the ultimate protest in 1965. A horrified bystander outside the Pentagon in Washington gave this eyewitness report.
"There was a man, and he was shouting something to the crowd. It was unintelligible to me. He was holding a baby in his arms. And the next thing I noticed was that one side of him burst into flames. People in the crowd around yelled, asked the man to drop the baby, meaning get the baby away from the flames. Myself and several others found the baby on the walkway. I picked up the baby to bring her away from the scene. The others covered him with coats and tried to extinguish the flame."
Another man burned himself to death in front of the United Nations. President Johnson was stung by the opposition to his policy. He complained,
"Now, I don't hear any people worrying much about this word aggression. They talk about the bombs. They talk about intervention. They talk about fighting a war in rice paddies. They talk about what sacrifices we are required to make. But all of our history, we have died in order to keep our contracts, in order to protect human beings. And the point I want to make is why don't people concern themselves something with a country that's trying to maintain her independence from aggression?"
America tried over and over again for a negotiated settlement. But the communist North Vietnamese and the Red Chinese refused to meet without conditions with U.S. representatives. The feeling at the State Department was that while the communists thought they were winning, they would reject every peace overture. The massive buildup began to bleed America's standing army at home, and the president was forced to say,
"This will make it necessary to increase our active fighting forces by raising the monthly draft call from 17,000 over a period of time to 35,000 per month, and for us to step up our campaign for our voluntary enlistments. After this past week of deliberations, I have concluded that it is not essential to order reserve units into service now."
On the home front, another effect of the war became increasingly evident at year's end. The conflict would require the nation to tighten its belt economically. Some domestic programs would lose money to Vietnam, and the president would have to control the economy more rigidly. He did not seek a legislative hold on wages and prices, but he did use his influence and his gigantic copper and aluminum stockpiles to beat back price hikes in those industries. Overall, America's record prosperity continued, however. It seemed well able to absorb the depressing effect of an increase in the cost of credit imposed by the Federal Reserve Board. And the war increasingly became a political issue. Barry Goldwater recalled,
"Remember, I was called trigger-happy and a warmonger when I suggested doing this 3 years ago."
On Vietnam and most other matters of substance, the United Nations was paralyzed in 1965 by a money dispute. America demanded that Russia, France, and other nations pay their share of peacekeeping operations in the Congo and Middle East, or, under Article 19 of the Charter, lose their vote in the General Assembly. This issue deadlocked the Assembly for months, and the U.S. finally gave up. Our ambassador to the U.N., Arthur Goldberg, said the United States would no longer press the issue, but he warned,
"We must make clear, crystal clear, that if any member can insist on making an exception to the principle of collective financial responsibility with respect to certain activities of the organization, the United States reserves the same option to make exceptions if, in our view, strong and compelling reasons exist for doing so."
Vietnam was not the only armed conflict of 1965, and not the only one in which Americans fought. Revolution flared in the Dominican Republic. American Embassy spokesman Malcolm McLean described the chaos.
There's been very little firing in the city during the night. There are some tanks running around here and there, but not shooting. There's no planes flying overhead. Most people waiting for the dawn. So far, there's been no indication to date of any effort to turn this thing against American nationals or against the American Embassy. There have been no demonstrations at the embassy. There have been no attacks on American citizens or on American property.
But President Johnson said he felt American lives were threatened, and he sent in the Marines.
"I've ordered the Secretary of Defense to put the necessary American troops ashore in order to give protection to hundreds of Americans who are still in the Dominican Republic and to escort them safely back to this country. This same assistance will be available to the nationals of other countries, some of whom have already asked for our help. Pursuant to my instructions, 400 Marines have already landed. General Wheeler, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has just reported to me that there have been no incidents."
The safety of Americans was the only reason stated at first. But the Dominican Republic is on the island of Hispaniola, next door to Cuba, and the danger of a communist takeover was apparent to the president. A few days later, he said,
"We don't propose to sit here in our rocking chair with our hands folded and let the communists set up any government in the Western Hemisphere."
Q Cuba itself came into the news later this year. Bearded dictator Fidel Castro suddenly offered to let his people go, some of them anyhow. President Johnson, in a dramatic speech beneath the Statue of Liberty, opened America's doors to the Cubans. Before formal arrangements could be concluded, however, an illegal armada of small vessels left the United States to ferry refugees back to Florida. They were breaking State Department rules and risking arrest upon their return. But as one skipper said,
"Now, if the United States thinks that they can deny my freedom for giving other people freedom, well, this is what they're going to have to do. But I'll do it again if I have a chance, but this is what's right."
Finally, the delicate negotiations were completed, and American planes began to fly thousands of dissatisfied Cubans to freedom. America had other foreign problems in 1965, some within the Atlantic Alliance, and as usual, there were problems with President de Gaulle of France. Cool in recent years, our relations with France were further chilled when evidence was produced that an American reconnaissance plane had photographed a secret French military installation. De Gaulle had his own problems at home. He was humiliated in December when the French refused him the frank and massive endorsement he asked for. De Gaulle was forced to obtain his new 7-year presidential term after a degrading runoff election against left-wing candidate François Mitterrand. Still, De Gaulle did stay in. Less fortunate was Ahmed Ben Bella. A bloodless coup threw out the former Algerian premier on the eve of a scheduled Afro-Asian conference in Algiers, which never really came off. It was canceled because of the Peking-Moscow struggle for world communist leadership. Another bloodless military coup deposed Premier Kasavubu of the Congo. In Indonesia, dictator Sukarno was almost knocked out by a communist coup, but the military saved him and started the first purge of communists in the island nation's modern history. Indonesia kept up its hit-and-run war with Malaysia right through a split in that federation when Singapore set up its own independent government. A full-fledged war was raging on the Indian subcontinent. The disputed territory of Kashmir was once again the object of fighting between India and Pakistan, as it has been since the two became free and separate states in 1948. First came ground skirmishes, then the bombing of major cities. Correspondent John Barton watched the effect on New Delhi, the capital of India.
"I saw this capital of India become a capital of darkness tonight, as lights went out all over the city for protection against possible air raids. Officials have ordered traffic to be reduced to a minimum tonight on all the city roads, and drivers must use only dim lights. I also saw many Delhi residents today busy digging deep trenches around their houses to be used in case shelter is needed. And New Delhi officials have asked the public to immediately report anyone thought to be Pakistani paratroopers dropped in this capital city of India."
The United Nations Security Council, with the United States and Russia acting in concert for the first time in years, unanimously called for and obtained a ceasefire. The dispute is still not settled, but a shaky truce prevails for the time being. In Africa, new trouble was brewing in Rhodesia. Premier Ian Smith threatened for weeks, then finally acted to break away from Great Britain.
"We have struck a blow for the preservation of justice, civilization, and Christianity. And in the spirit of this belief, we have this day assumed our sovereign independence. God bless you all."
Premier Smith drew the wrath of the entire world, except for South Africa, Portugal, and the Portuguese colonies, all of which have similar racial policies. Britain had made a new enemy in Africa. But the globe-trotting royal family was making new friends elsewhere. Queen Elizabeth toured Germany and was a hit in the divided city of Berlin. Princess Margaret and husband Tony wowed the United States from the West Coast to the White House.
"Thank you so much. Your very warm welcome. I'm so grateful to you for giving me this opportunity on this first day of my first visit to the United States of America to say how happy we both are to be here. I've longed to come to this country for ages, and I'm so thrilled that it has now become a reality. We are delighted that our visit should start here in your beautiful city of San Francisco, of which I've heard so much. We both look forward to seeing as much as we can of the United States and to meeting many people in all walks of life."
Another world traveler was Pope Paul VI, who became the first reigning pontiff ever to visit the Americas. He flew to New York to address to the United Nations a plea for peace. He spoke in French.
It suffices to remember that the blood of millions of men, that numberless and unheard of sufferings, useless slaughter, frightful ruin, are the sanction of the pact which unites you with an oath which must change the future history of the world. No more war, never again war. Peace, it is peace which must guide the destinies of peoples and of all mankind.
The Pope spent a long day in New York, meeting with President Johnson and celebrating a mass for peace in Yankee Stadium. The Pope's history-making trip to the UN had little visible effect on the remaining business before the world body. He had urged by implication that Red China be admitted, but the communist regime was refused entry for the 15th time.
The result of the vote is the following. In favor, 47. Against, 47. Abstentions, 20. The proposal, therefore, is not adopted.
It was the closest vote ever, apparently showing a gradual weakening of the opposition to seating Red China. As usual, the UN gained a few members, but for the first time in history, it lost one. Sukarno pulled Indonesia out. Later, a disillusioned Cambodia all but pulled out. Washington to Watts, from Selma to Chicago, the civil rights movement progressed by demonstration and legislation. In Washington, the Voting Rights Bill passed. As federal voting registrars spread through the hardcore segregationist counties of the South, demonstrations continued. In Chicago, they campaigned against de facto segregation. In Selma, they protested state-sanctioned separation of the races. Microphones and cameras recorded the violence as club-swinging police broke up an attempted march from Selma to Montgomery, the state capital. Yet Alabama Governor George Wallace said,
"No one was hit on the ground in Selma, Alabama. Not at all. And only seven, I think, were injured enough to stay any time in the hospital."
A federal court finally told Wallace to permit and protect the march. It was immediately after this five-day journey to Montgomery that white civil rights worker Viola Liuzzo was murdered. Ku Klux Klansman Collie Leroy Wilkins was charged with the slaying. A first all-white jury deadlocked, a second acquitted him, and then in federal court, Wilkins and two other men received 10-year prison terms for violating Mrs. Liuzzo's civil rights. Another civil rights worker, the Reverend James Reeve of Boston, was beaten to death. President Johnson said,
"What happened in Selma was an American tragedy. The blows that were received, the blood that was shed, the life of the good man that was lost, must strengthen the determination of each of us to bring full and equal and exact justice to all of our people."
The jury system of the South became the next target of the Johnson administration, as the president called for legislation
that is clear in its purpose and specific in its aim. And that aim is to prevent injustice to Negroes at the hands of all white juries.
Soon afterward, a white man was convicted of a racial murder by a Southern all-white jury for the first time in modern history. Hubert Strange was found guilty of slaying foundry worker Willie Brewster. The violence of Selma was eclipsed by an incredible week of full-scale rioting in Los Angeles. The arrest of a Negro motorist touched off terrorism, sniping, and looting in the black ghetto called the Watts District.
You see what he's done over there, man?
Governor Brown had to call out the National Guard.
Most of the people in this great city, regardless of color, want to return to normal. This tragedy is now being prolonged by hit-and-run hoodlums and terrorists. This is now a case of guerrilla fighting with gangsters. I want it clearly understood that the Guard will remain here in force until the streets of Los Angeles are safe, and will continue to track down these hoodlums aggressively.
Around the country in 1965, a new type of demonstration came of age, the protest for peace.
Sing it with me. We are soldiers in the army.
The demonstrators were mostly young people and mostly the same ones who marched for civil rights last year. There were sit-ins on Capitol Hill and, for the first time in history, a sit-in at the White House.
We die, we are soldiers in the army. We have to fight it, although we have to cry. We have to hold.
It was also a year of familiar protest by labor against management. A maritime strike tied up East and Gulf Coast shipping. Two aerospace strikes threatened the space program for a while. The New York papers were closed down again by a combination of strike and lockout. The biggest threat of all to industry was a looming steel strike. But President Johnson got both sides up to the White House, and after a week of tough bargaining and presidential arm twisting, they settled. Legislatively, the famous Texas twist was most in evidence on Capitol Hill. Correspondent John Chambers reports.
So many members of the 89th Congress owe President Lyndon Johnson their political life that the first session was his from beginning to end. What dissent there was came primarily over foreign policy, and curiously, fellow Democrats made the harshest accusations. But these same Democrats helped the president write and pass three revolutionary education laws. In a speech for Negro equality, the president made his most dramatic appeal to Congress.
On this issue, there must be no delay or no hesitation or no compromise with our purpose.
Progress was slow, but by summer, the voter rights law of 1965 was written, and Mr. Johnson made a special trip, one of several, for bill signings, this one to the Capitol to sign the voter rights law. Before it passed, the Congress voted to cut the excise taxes imposed during the Korean War. Congress approved a revolutionary medical care for the aged law, a hospital care plan financed under Social Security in a voluntary program. The first session gave Lyndon Johnson a new cabinet officer to head a new housing and urban development department, made it a federal crime to assassinate a president or vice president, and asked the states to approve a presidential disability and succession constitutional amendment. It put on cigarette packages a health warning, made draft card burning a federal crime, raised the salaries of the military and federal employees, and even gave Mrs. Johnson a treasure, the Highway Beautification Law. It went along with the desilvering of coins, and it approved a complete change in immigration laws. Right up to the end, President Johnson and House Republican leader Gerald Ford fought.
I feel that the Congress in 1965... in practically every instance, is a rubber stamp to the White House. The Congress today, the legislative branch in Washington, does not work its own will, does not exercise any independence. They are purely an adjunct to the executive branch of the government, and as a consequence, I fear in the long run, the loss of freedom and the loss of some of the heritage of our American system.
Great pains were taken to ease the shock of the announcement. But still the nation and the world worried when presidential spokesman Bill Moyers announced,
"The doctors recommended that the gallbladder be removed. The president, therefore, will enter Bethesda Naval Hospital Thursday night for surgery Friday. The doctors expect there will be only a minimal time during which the president will not be conducting business as usual."
The operation was a complete success, but there were several hours of uncertainty during which Vice President Humphrey was in charge. What kind of a day was it for him?
I think everything has gone very well, sir.
How would you describe your day, sir?
Just an ordinarily busy day. just as we generally have.
When will you give command back to the president?
Well, those matters take care of themselves. The president's feeling fine.
Despite the success of the removal of the president's gallbladder and a kidney stone, it took the chief executive the rest of the year to recover fully. He spent almost 2 months at his LBJ ranch in Texas with only two brief trips back to Washington. As Mr. Johnson regained his strength, the nation was shocked to hear that former President Eisenhower was seriously ill. He suffered a third heart attack, but was recovering quickly and promised to be back on the golf course soon. This year, as every year, the world lost many of its outstanding personalities. Sir Winston Churchill, an American citizen as well as a British subject.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
America's statesman and ambassador to the world, Adlai Stevenson.
Mr. Zorin, let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
I am not in an American courtroom, sir, and therefore I do not wish to answer a question that is put to me in the fashion in which a prosecutor does. In due course, sir, you will have your reply.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
Former Vice President Henry Wallace.
The other day I was told the story for the first time of how our big medical schools are training their students to take care of atomic bomb victims, getting ready to put together tremendous piles of penicillin, vast quantities of blood serum. This shocked me, because I was in on the atomic bomb proposition long before Hiroshima. I want to see our work with the atomic energy being done on the basis of making that energy available for peace. At the present time, 90% of our...
Former South Korean President Syngman Rhee.
There is a little time. Within a few years, the Soviet Union will possess the means to vanquish the United States. We must act now. Where can we act? We can act in the Far East. Ladies and gentlemen, the Korean front comprises only one small portion of the war. We want to win the war for Asia.
And many others whose names made political, social, and cultural history. Several major disasters also took lives this year. There were killer plane crashes in New York, Lake Michigan, Salt Lake City, Cincinnati, Hong Kong, and Paris. Hurricane Betsy ripped up Florida and Louisiana. Killer tornadoes and floods hit the Midwest while the Northeast thirsted for enough water to survive. A cruise ship burned and sank between Florida and Bermuda, killing about 90 fun-seeking passengers. A volcano erupted near Manila, its deadly lava rolling over the land, destroying everything in its path. A major disaster that might have been was the terrifying blackout of northeastern America. While a moonlit night and the almost incredible composure of New York prevented widespread tragedy, the power failure pointed up America's increasing dependence on electricity and automatic devices. Nowhere are automatic devices more important than in the transistorized mazes of Cape Kennedy and the Houston Space Center, and in the rockets and manned capsules they hurl into space. And in 1965, the devices worked pretty well, enabling the United States to end the year with history's first rendezvous between two orbiting spaceships. A Russian astronaut this year took the first walk in outer space. Russia also sent several instrument packages to the moon, but their attempted soft landings failed. France became the third nation to orbit a satellite with its own rocket. America took close-up pictures of the moon and Mars and continued to build its worldwide communications network. But America's most spectacular efforts were steps in the Gemini program, our stairway to the moon. Gemini 3, with astronauts Gus Grissom and John Young, became America's first two-man spaceflight. President Johnson was appreciative.
I know that I speak for the rest of this country when I tell you that we're very proud of you and that we're very grateful for your safe return. Your mission, Gus, confirms once again the vital role that man has to play in space exploration, and particularly in the peaceful use of the frontier of space. I'm sure you would be the first to say that on this flight, as well as on our other manned flights in space, there were heroes on the ground as well as in space, and the record made by men like Jim Webb and Dr. Dryden and Dr. Siemens, as well as all of those at the Cape, Cape Kennedy, and around the world is a very proud record, both under Project Mercury and now on Project Gemini. And to all of those who've helped make our space flight safe and successful, I want to, through you and through others that are listening, say well done.
Then in June came Gemini 4 with space twins McDivitt and White up for 62 orbits, slightly under 98 hours. It was here an American first walked in space. This was the conversation as Ed White floated outside the Gemini spaceship.
Okay, get out of front where I can see you again. I've only got about three on the hospital block.
Okay.
Where are you?
Oh,
you don't have the control
here. Yes, smile. I'm
looking
right down your gun
barrel.
All right.
Let me take a close-up picture there. Oh, you speared up my windshield, you dirty dog.
White enjoyed his walk in space so much that it took a direct order from the ground to get him back in the spaceship. In August, Gemini 5 carried astronauts Cooper and Conrad around the world 120 times in almost 191 hours for a new endurance record. But here there was a partial failure. Because of fuel cell trouble, they had to cancel attempts to rendezvous with an instrument pod.
Gemini 5, this is Houston here. Over. Roger, Gemini 5, this is Houston here. Be advised, there will be no, I say again, there will be no Holmes burns over the States. We will not attempt to rendezvous with the rep.
Roger, understand, no rendezvous and there will be no burns.
That's affirmative. Later on in the mission, we expect to do some burns and we can bring the platform up. And we'll run through some exercises using the fuel for that.
Okay.
Later, the problem did clear up, and space officials put Gemini 5 through maneuvers to rendezvous with the Phantom, a Gina rocket. In theory, anyhow, this proved that the space chase could be completed successfully. A rendezvous attempt with a real Agena rocket, scheduled for Gemini 6, didn't get far before there was a failure. And astronauts Stafford and Shira heard these words.
The mission has been scrubbed. We have scrubbed the mission for the day. Because Carnarvon has not acquired, we can assume the Atlas, the Agena vehicle, went into the Atlantic some 5,500 miles short of the desired velocity. The flight director scrubbed the mission at about 54 minutes after the hour.
Gemini 6 was rescheduled as part of a year-end space spectacular, Gemini 76. 7 was to orbit first. Then a week or so later, they'd send off Gemini 6, and the two would meet in space. But on the first attempt to launch 6, we heard...
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2... 1-0.
Now we've got a shutdown. No liftoff. The engines have shut down. Fuel pressure is lowering, Wally Shira says. Apparently a safe condition. Fuel pressure down about 32. We're watching the fuel pressure lower very carefully.
pressure lowering nicely. Blockhouse is asking for a readout on all tank pressures. Elliot C is putting in a call to 7 to advise them that we will not have a liftoff. Frank Borman says, Roger, we saw it. We saw it light up. We saw it shut down.
The shot was aborted, but 3 days later, it lifted off on schedule, and 5.5 hours after that, the 4 astronauts in 2 spacecraft were close enough to look through the ports and see each other as they flew nose to nose.
Just about 10 feet above it to the left of 7. We're just flying nose to nose, approximately 15 feet apart.
Roger.
We can very clearly see the horizon scanners operating.
Roger, Tim.
At one point, Shira saw a strap hanging from the Gemini 7 capsule. And so it went on as the two craft flew around each other with the spacemen talking and snapping pictures. If the accomplishments of the United States in space during 1965 seem to recall the days of Buck Rogers, even they seem to pale alongside the flurry of reports of unidentified flying objects, or as some call them, flying saucers. The reports came from many places throughout the Mid and Southwest, like this report from Deputy Sheriff Everett Tucker of Wellington, Kansas.
Got a call out of Wichita and said it had been confirmed on these objects, and my wife and I were out on the roof, and we did see this object to the east, and it was a big round flame, you know, and there was vapor going out the back, but it looked like fire, not vapor smoke. And it was a long ways off, but it is pretty big. It was enormous. It had to be, because it looked about like a horse tank from where I seen it.
Space officials called it ridiculous. But was it mass hypnosis, overactive imagination, an experimental spacecraft, or a new military weapon? Was it theirs or ours? Or was it really a visitor from outer space? Who's to know? With all that happened in 1965, almost anything is believable. This has been 1965 in Review, a production of the United Press International Audio Network. Produced and directed by Fred Dressler. This is Pi Chamberlain.